Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this 4th of July holiday with an analysis of the foundation of American democracy, our electoral system that has been under attack by the Russians and is now being attacked by the Trump administration in order to prove an outrageous and unsupported claim by Trump that 5 million illegals voted in the last election, which was why Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million. Andrew Gumbel, an award-winning investigative reporter and author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, joins us to discuss the bogus commission that Donald Trump has set up, chaired by Vice President Mike Pence and Kris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, who is the country's leading crusader against the imaginary scourge of voter fraud. Needless to say, Trump's commission, which is not looking into the role of the Russian hacking of our election, but is comprised of voter suppression zealots, will be using the specter of voter fraud to deny the votes of minorities who vote Democratic, as has already happened in Kobach's Kansas. We'll also look into why the majority of the nation's secretaries of states have rejected the commission's demand for personal data on voters' voting habits, partial social security numbers, and other personal data, which will be housed on an unsecured website. Then we'll examine further Trump's partisan electoral purge and the abuse of the power of the presidency, where the delusions of an insecure narcissist still obsessed with his loss in the popular vote, who championed an earlier witch hunt against Obama based on the lie that Obama did not have a birth certificate, is now commissioning a wild goose chase that could end up as a cover for voter suppression. Michael Lewis Beck, a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Iowa, whose interests include comparative elections, election forecasting, political economy, and quantitative methodology, joins us to investigate the lack of a strategy to counter the Trump disaster on the part of Democrats, too many of whom are invested in the notion that Trump will be impeached. We will discuss the lack of an alternative narrative of what the Democrats would replace Trump with in terms of a vision of a better America for all and leadership that could heal the country's divisions and bring America back to greatness. And joining us on this 4th of July holiday is Andrew Gumbel, an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Thank you so much.
And it seems that, obviously, elections are at the heart of democracy, and democracy is at the heart of the 4th of July celebration. But we have an extraordinary situation now where you have a president who has all kinds of peculiar obsessions with the press and with his own ego, and insists that 5 million illegals or mythical people of some sort, un-Americans, non-Americans, whatever, voted in this election, and that's why Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million. So he has formed this electoral commission headed by a zealot, a voter suppression zealot. And meanwhile, in the real world, we do have a problem, Houston. We have a problem, which is that the Russians hacked into the last election, and according to the latest leak from an NSA contractor via The Intercept, they are all preparing to infiltrate, I think, about half of the electoral systems in the country. So this would be a great opportunity to fix our broken electoral system, but instead, Trump is sending the country on this wild goose chase.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that there are a number of sort of things just to sort of take one step at a time to sort of make sense of what's going on. You know, first of all, there have been many presidential commissions in the past looking at the voting system. They have always been bipartisan commissions. This one doesn't even pretend to be bipartisan. You have Mike Pence as the nominal chair. You have Kris Kobach, the zealot you referred to earlier, the Kansas Secretary of State, who is the vice chair and essentially driving the process as far as we can see. And then you have pretty much, you know, the cast of characters of everybody who's been pointed to as somebody advocating voter suppression in one form or another over the last 20 years has found their way onto this commission. Beyond Kobach, there's also Hans van Spakovsky, a Georgia lawyer who first came to prominence by promoting the idea of a purged list to get rid of, you know, felons, illegals, and others off the voter rolls. And this was instituted in Florida ahead of the 2000 presidential election, and almost certainly disenfranchised a very large number of African-American voters. When one county did an audit of the purge list, they found that 95% of the names on it should not have been there. These were legitimate voters who should not have been purged. So, you know, the people involved in this initiative have a very shoddy history, of, you know, a startling history, really. Kobach himself in Kansas has got himself into legal trouble. He attempted to separate out rules for federal elections versus state elections because he wanted to introduce draconian measures for proving people's citizenship. He's also introduced a proprietary piece of software that was initiated in Kansas called CrossCheck, the idea of which is to make sure that people aren't voting twice in different states. However, studies have shown that for every, you know, genuine example of somebody voting twice in different states, there are 200 instances of people who've been falsely identified as having done so. And by the way, being registered in two different states is not illegal. Only voting in two different states in the same election is illegal. So, you know, these people are not coming at it in a dispassionate way. They're coming at it with a purpose, with an ideological aim. And the other thing that's worth pointing out in terms of background is that, you know, this is not a new thing in American history, that you have what sounds like, you know, a reasonable task. Calling something the Advisory Commission on Election Integrity sounds all well and good, but it's really Orwellian doublespeak. It's actually meant to do the opposite of what it sets out to do. Same thing happened at the end of the 19th century when, you know, in the name of voter integrity, common sense measures against fraud, African Americans in the South and a lot of poor whites were just systematically disenfranchised through a series of election reforms. And we're in danger of having the same thing happen here. Fortunately, people are onto it. And also, fortunately, I would say, the commission, at least so far, has not demonstrated a great deal of strategic savvy in how it goes about what it's doing. Last week, Mr. Kobach sent out a letter to all 50 states demanding an awful lot of information about voters, their names, their middle initials, their social security numbers, their criminal histories, their voting preferences, their party affiliation, a lot of information that, you know, if you ask people who are experts on trying to figure out how to improve the accuracy of voter rolls would tell you this is a very bizarre way of going about it, unless your purpose is to try and make matches that are designed to kick people off those voter rolls, which is the great suspicion here. Kobach's letter, however, was so broad that it caused almost half the states either partially or completely to tell him to take a running jump. And in fact, in the case of Mississippi, which is hardly a liberal bastion, the Republican Secretary of State there literally told him to go take a jump into the Gulf of Mexico. So this has not been a successful initiative so far. However, the danger remains. The full power and prestige of the White House is behind this effort. And we'll see going forward what kinds of pressures can be applied back to try and stop Kobach and his cohorts from doing their worst.
Well, the point that you just made, Andrew, I guess obliquely, is that elections matter. They have consequences. This president, in spite of the fact that this is a trumped-up piece of nonsense based upon his own personal peculiarities about his ego, and it's like the whole thing about the day after the election when his press secretary had to come out and say that there were more people at the Trump inauguration than there were at the Obama inauguration, when indeed the evidence was to the contrary. Then he spoke at the CIA about it, and he's still obsessed with it. And that's why we have this commission to prove the unprovable. But nevertheless, it's going ahead. It just shows you that presidents have power. Isn't that the lesson to be learned here?
That's true, but it's interesting that some of the structural weaknesses of the American electoral system may now turn out to be hidden strengths, in the sense that, you know, we have a highly devolved electoral system where states primarily, and in some cases local jurisdictions, make the key decisions. And that has been very bad for the country in many ways, because it means there's no oversight, there are no standards, there's no uniformity in how things are done, which is how it works in other countries, which means that, you know, historically there have been parts of the country where elections are very well administered, and then there are parts of the country like Florida, for example, where historically elections have been highly dubious in many instances. And over the last 10, 15 years, where we've seen the Republican takeover of state legislatures, we have seen a number of those legislatures pass, you know, laws that seem designed to restrict ballot access, the introduction of voter ID laws, you know, restricting early voting, and so on and so forth, all of which seem to be done for partisan advantage rather than in the interests of American democracy. And you know, this free-for-all is on the one hand given Trump the opportunity to push it further, and it seems that the goal here is to take, you know, what began with state-by-state voter ID laws and take it to a whole new level of systematically disenfranchising people who look likely to vote for someone other than Donald Trump or the Republicans. But on the other hand, it exposes this interesting opposition in American politics between the states and the federal government. And that's, I think, why you see a state like Mississippi, which certainly, you know, is Republican to the core, pushing back and saying this is a states' rights thing. We run our own elections, thank you very much. And, of course, Mississippi does not have a stellar record of running fair elections over its history. It was probably one of the worst segregationist states when it came to voting rights during the Jim Crow era. But, you know, you see that states' rights impulse kicking right in. You see in a state like Ohio, which historically has run pretty good elections over the last 10, 15 years, it's been heavily tainted by bipartisan problems as well. But you see the Secretary of State there, John Husted, a Republican, somebody who's been in the crosshairs of voting rights experts for things he's done wrong, pushing back and telling the White House, you know what, we run perfectly good elections here. Thank you very much. We don't need you to interfere and tell us what to do. To get back to your first point, you know, there are many ways in which the system could be improved. It's been studied a lot. It wouldn't be that hard to do if the will was there. Needless to say, it does not involve obsessing about individual voter fraud, and certainly not voter fraud on the kind of scale that Trump and co. are talking about in the millions. But there is an issue with having the registration system run more smoothly. The Brennan Center for Justice, for example, has come up with a lot of good suggestions where you would essentially make automatic voter registration the norm across the country. It exists in Oregon. It's coming in California. But if you made that the norm across the country and then had a system whereby the registration information is tracked by the voter rather than by the state, so if on election day you vote, let's say, in California, but you're also registered in New York, the system would automatically register that you have voted in place X. And if you tried to vote in another place, it would actually stop you from doing so. You know, this kind of common sense approach to make sure that you try and get rid of the names on the voter rolls that are no longer valid because people are dead or they've moved away or whatever it is, and at the same time make sure that anybody who wants to vote can. You know, this is not rocket science. This is a doable thing. Countries do it around the world, and the United States could easily do it. Instead of which, you know, we have sadly a situation that's been going on, you know, in its more exacerbated form, you know, since the 2000 election, I would argue, but in one form or another, really since the founding of the country, where what should be a dispassionately run system for the benefit of democracy and the interests of the American people has been tainted by politicization. And Trump did not start this, but he's both pushing it to a new level and, I would argue, turning it into something of a farce. And we don't know if that farcical element is going to be the saving grace because everybody's going to be able to see through it, or if it's actually going to make things a whole lot worse. We're at a very dangerous point at this moment.
Well, in terms of farce, there's nothing more farcical than the idea that these people, Kovach and Pence, are asking for extremely private information like your social security numbers, etc., and they're developing a huge database. And your voting record, for example, is also a part of their requests. But their requests go to an unsecured website. They've already set up this unsecured website. I mean, isn't that absurd, the idea that they're worried about, or maybe they're not worried about people hacking into the election rolls, but the idea that all of this is being, this extremely personal data is being gathered and then posted on an unsecured website is surreal.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, it goes again to the fact that this is, you know, in many ways this is amateur hour. They haven't thought this through. In the most basic of ways, and there's no better example of how they haven't thought this through than the fact that one of the states that's pushed back against the request and say it's not actually in compliance with state law is Kansas, where Kris Kobach is still the Secretary of State. So he told his own, in response to his own letter, he has said, we can't do this. at least to the extent that we can't provide social security numbers, not even partial ones, because that's not in compliance with Kansas law. And a number of other states that, you know, might otherwise be sympathetic to the idea of purging, you know, essentially Democrats from the voter rolls in as large numbers as possible, have also pushed back on the grounds of, you know, issues in state law. So they haven't thought of that. They haven't thought of computer security. And, you know, it may be that they don't care about the security of the information, as you say, or it may be that they just haven't thought about it. But it's certainly going to be a concern for the states that are being asked to provide this information. You know, the other question is, what are they going to end up with if, you know, only a fraction of the states, let's say a third, provide, you know, information along the lines that they're suggesting? It's not clear what they can really do with that information. Are they going to do a kind of a national version of CrossCheck? Well, CrossCheck already has 30 states involved, so it's not clear they can really expand significantly beyond that. Are they going to do some kind of nationwide voter purge along the lines we saw in Florida ahead of the 2000 election? I think we're going to see a lot of legal challenges to that. I think, you know, again, people are aware that this is not an honest effort. And so, you know, it's not clear what they can do with that. And if the, you know, the vast majority of the suspected votes, you know, if you take Trump seriously for a moment, which we shouldn't, the vast majority of illegal votes, quote unquote, in the election came from California. California has said point blank, we're not handing you the information. So, you know, what are you going to do with that? You know, what votes are you going to be able to suppress? It's not clear they're going to be able to do an awful lot. Having said that, you know, the very fact that they're doing this with the prestige of the White House, you know, further politicizes the process. It taints the whole concept of how elections are run in this country, and it makes it harder and harder to imagine a system that's going to become fairer and more transparent as opposed to the opposite. And, you know, that's something that's of grave concern to anybody who cares about voting rights in this country.
Well, if a third comply, assuming that the third that comply with Kovach and Pence are these sort of stalwart red states with very partisan Republican secretaries of state, that would be my guess. What are they going to do with this information? I mean, would they basically, the object would be to secure the Republican majority ad infinitum into the distant future? Because as far as I can tell, what Kovach is really trying to do on a national scale here is what he's already done in Kansas. And that's where I think we should be really alarmed. What he's already done in Kansas is required, in order to register to vote, you have to show a passport and a birth certificate. And I defy our listeners to, you know, I imagine that most of our listeners couldn't find their birth certificate if they had to. And a lot of them don't have passports. And we already know from data that there's been a huge drop-off in registration in the state of Kansas. I think 1 in 7 have been purged or haven't shown up with the adequate ID. So if you extrapolate that 1 in 7 nationwide, that's an awful lot of people that would be disenfranchised by Kovach and Pence.
Right. And again, you know, we don't know what his goal is. You know, all he said on the record so far in a couple of interviews, one with NPR, one with the Kansas City Star, is that this is about weeding out fraud and weeding out, you know, illegitimate voters, which is consistent with the suspicion of what he's up to. So, you know, I think we should give him the benefit of the doubt to the extent that we don't know exactly what the plan is. And by benefit of the doubt, I just mean simply we shouldn't assert as fact something that we have to wait and see exactly what's going to happen. The other point, I think, is, you know, I don't know how much of that, you know, even if that was his agenda, as you laid it out, how much he could get away with between legal challenges, between states not cooperating, and even, you know, some certain Republican states objecting to the idea of the federal government laying down the law. You know, they've resisted that for a long time. You know, people like me have advocated for a long time saying, you know, we should actually have more federal control of elections, you know, to set standards, to buy up voting machines en masse from reliable sources, to safeguard cybersecurity, and so on and so forth, you know, which are all the real issues. And that has always seemed politically very tough because the states don't want the federal government to be in charge. And I think, you know, in Republican-run states, on the one hand, they probably have some kind of party allegiance and they have some sympathy to the project of making it easier for Republicans to win elections. On the other hand, they do not like being told what to do by the federal government. They certainly don't like being told that their elections are riddled with errors when their job is to run those elections. You know, as we've seen, a number of Republican secretaries of state have came out after November and again now saying, excuse me, but we run perfectly fine elections and there was no mass voter fraud. So, you know, have these contradictory impulses and political agendas that will play out, and we'll just have to see what happens, you know, which way it goes. And again, you know, just to reiterate my point, I think this is a very dangerous moment, but there's also, we don't know whether things are going to go the way Kobach and Pence want, or if there's going to be pushback that's effective. And, you know, we also don't know what the courts are going to do, and we don't know exactly what the Supreme Court's composition is going to be like on these kinds of questions now that we have Neil Gorsuch on board. Whether they can muster 5 votes to endorse this kind of voter suppression, or whether they can't. We just have to wait and see.
Well, just in closing, we know that President Obama, in fact, Trump himself is accusing Obama of being responsible for not doing anything about the Russian hacking, and that Obama, when he the intelligence services told him that the Russians were hacking and the intelligence people had somebody inside Putin's inner circle that were able to tell them that it was being directed by Putin. And Obama had a dilemma of going public. Obviously, they thought Hillary was going to win, and that may be why they didn't say anything. But he was worried about he tried to get a bipartisan statement, and Mitch McConnell wouldn't go along with it. But apparently, he also was concerned that if he called out Putin before the elections, then Putin could double down and hack the elections and cause chaos. So the fact that a foreign power could hack our elections ought to be a red flag that's got every American on this patriotic holiday thinking, well, God, you know, if anybody around the world can hack our elections, then we ought to do something about it.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, one thing that has been a concern in the abstract for a long time is that voting machines, and in particular some of the electronic voting machines that were introduced after the 2000 election, are badly designed, badly programmed, you know, vulnerable to all kinds of risks. And, you know, there have been documented instances where computer scientists have managed to break into these systems and have warned, you know, others could do so easily. You also have still in about 10% of the country electronic machines that produce no independently verifiable paper trail. So if there's a hack, there's no way of being sure that it's happened. You know, these are serious problems that need addressing. It would take money. It would take federal money because a lot of these states don't have the funds necessary to replace their machines. It would take some kind of national commission to determine what is it, you know, having made the mistake last time of buying machines that were not safe, we need to do it properly this time. So you'd need to have, you know, proper guidance, proper standards. All these things are things that, you know, in an ideal world would now be undertaken by the federal government in response to what happened in the 2016 election. We're seeing absolutely none of it from the Trump White House, and we're seeing actually the opposite. You know, we're seeing indications that voter data is going to become less secure. We're seeing indications that there is, you know, an aggressive lack of interest in solving the problems that actually exist. Instead, you know, a very concerted effort to go after, you know, bogus problems that play into a partisan agenda. So it is both, you know, undermining democracy, it is hyper-partisanship, and it's also the height of irresponsibility in terms of running a country.
Well, Andrew Gumbel, I thank you for joining us on this 4th of July holiday.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who's an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining further Trump's partisan electoral purge and the abuse of power of this president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now on this 4th of July holiday is Michael Lewis Beck, a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Iowa, whose interests include comparative elections, election forecasting, political economy, and quantitative methodology. He has co-authored over 275 articles and books, including Economics and Elections, The American Voter Revisited, French Presidential Elections, and Forecasting Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lewis Beck.
Happy to be here.
And of course, Michael, we have over this 4th of July weekend where people celebrate patriotism, a couple of things that we should be thinking about. One is that the very foundation of our democratic system, our elections, were attacked by a foreign adversary. And we have a president who apparently doesn't believe it happened, or if he does, he doesn't want to do anything about it. But at the same time, he's got an election commission that's going around trying to get all the states to give up confidential information about its voters, and all under the idea of purging the voting rolls of this mythical 5 million phony voters, phantom voters who were responsible for Hillary Clinton getting 3 million more votes in the popular vote than he did. So I don't know where to begin, frankly, thinking about who the President of the United States is.
Yeah, well, on that point, just let me mention, I'm proud to say that in Iowa, our elections commissioner refused to give the information out. So that's a very patriotic gesture on this 4th of July weekend.
Indeed. But what do you make of this incomprehensible president that we have?
Well, I travel abroad a lot. I just apologize to people. I mean, it's such an embarrassment at so many levels. At so many levels, the policy level and his personal shenanigans. It just gives me much grief. I spend a lot of time giving people political therapy. I say, think about it, take a good look at it, do what you can, and then put it away for a while and live your life. Because I know so many people who they're losing sleep, they're actually clinically depressed, and that's I've lived a long time. I don't remember maybe Nixon evoked, for some, almost as much, but I think it's more widespread now, and in certain ways it's more profound and more pathological even then, So there's some things to say, to think about.
But I think it's also created a kind of, even a delusion amongst Democrats, this wish that he would be impeached.
I think that is a delusion or an illusion. I mean, it's not as that's magical thinking, unfortunately, I think, because I understand the arguments, including taking money from foreign powers or being compromised by foreign powers. There's a constitutional amendment which talks about emoluments from foreign powers. In other words, being in the pay of foreign governments or in the hire of foreign governments, and this is a neglected amendment, part of the Constitution. It's been proposed that it be used. I've read some of the legal arguments for it. I think it's plausible, although I think to think about, I guess what I would say, if people want Trump out of office, they should concentrate on, building a bolder Democratic Party and electing him out. Because one of the problems is fixation on Trump, as dysfunctional he is at a personal and national political level. We've got, his opponents have to come up with a coherent policy and plan of action to defeat him. And I think that's because that also, I think, might appeal to some people who dig in and support Trump for reasons that what they might be able to think their way out of if they were given a good alternative.
But in that vein of wishful thinking that Trump will be impeached, and it goes back to a problem that the Democrats always seem to have, is hoping that they can simply run on the fact that the other guy is a train wreck. Now, you've never had more of a train wreck than Donald Trump. That's
I completely agree. This is a big mistake, and we're not getting anywhere with that strategy.
Right.
Because it just helps Trump supporters dig in. I mean, part of the thing that educated people, well, many people, political observers, good citizens, don't understand is that American voters, like voters in other democracies, they're very identified with their political causes or their political parties or their ideologies. So in the American case, 90% of the public, the voting public, has a party affiliation, a party identification. They say, I am a Democrat or I'm a Republican. And even if they say they're independents, if you probe them, what they'll say is, well, really, I'm leaning toward Republican or I'm leaning toward Democrat. So, and this is a very deep, people, this is what people don't understand. This is a very deep social psychological identification. It's almost like supporting your sports team. And so to get people off that dime is extremely difficult. And, you know, telling them that they're stupid or they're, you know, they don't see straight is not really very helpful because it's an emotional attachment. So one of the reasons that so many people went for Trump is he was the only game in town for a Republican. I know a lot of Republicans that, I mean, they say they didn't like Trump, but they voted for him because he was the party candidate. And that really is not exceptional. That's what Americans, and not only Americans, that's what people in democracies do. They support their party, or if they're leftists, they support the left. If they're rightists, they support the right. You know, I've done a lot of work in France. If someone says that they're, say, they say, je suis à droite, that they say they're on the right, they never, and the data show this, they never vote for a candidate from a party on the right, on the left, I mean. So these things are entrenched, I have a friend who he constantly says to me, I don't understand why Trump did so well. And this is just a fundamental point. It's an anchor in the American political system, like most democratic political systems. And this is an inertial quality in the system that you've got. It's very hard to overcome.
So obviously it's very tribal, and what I find particularly disturbing about Trump, particularly on this 4th of July holiday where we celebrate the nation's birth as a democracy, this is such a divisive president. We've never had somebody that's so actively, deliberately divisive, how he plays to his base and insults the rest of America, and particularly, which happens to be, by the way, the majority.
I agree.
And also he demonizes the press as the enemy of the people.
Yes, this is very unhealthy, very unhealthy. Threatens the press. It's very undemocratic, un-American, actually, I think. And so it's quite disturbing. I mean, the threats to civil liberties, the notion when you get high people in high places threatening a lawsuit or threatening, you know, some sort of punitive action or going public with your name, putting your name on a list, or it's very chilling. I was a member of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union board for some time, and this is one of my heartfelt issues, and I think it's important that this comes up on 4th of July to remember that and to remember what our founding fathers and mothers fought for and were courageous about and spoke out about. It was really those were glorious days when we were throwing the Brits out. And I detect some sort of an accent there. I'm not meaning to offend your home country.
No, well, I'm not a Brit. I was an Australian, I've become an American.
Fair enough.
And, of course, the Australians have a somewhat prickly relationship with the Brits. But I wish that Australia had its revolution, frankly, like the Americans did. But they can't cut the apron strings with the Queen, for reasons which are a bit mystifying.
Yes, I agree.
But going back to the King, I don't think we've had a leader of this country since pre-revolutionary days when we had the madness of King George III, who talked to trees. Now, I know a lot of people think it's a cheap shot to question the president's sanity, but you can't help it because of the bizarre behavior that he does.
This is true. I mean, one thing here, like when people ask me, who's been worse? I have thought about that. And, you know, Nixon comes up. I mean, he had some fairly as we know, fairly serious cycle, at least deep neuroses. He did some very strange things. There's two points I want to make about this. I'm old. I remember when Goldwater ran for president, the American Psychiatric Association, to its discredit, I have to say, they signed a big petition saying Goldwater was mentally unfit. And in fact, I mean, I knew Goldwater. I mean, I've never been a Republican, but I knew the man. He was a man of great integrity and moral righteousness and uncorruptible. So the Psychiatric Association was being irresponsible. And I only say this because, I mean, you know, it's that, well, I mean, what actually the profession now, the psychologists and psychiatrists have said, this is the kind of diagnosis that they only do on the couch, you know, they don't like to do this. And so I am aware of that. But mm-hmm. as a political scientist, a student of history, if I look at our presidents, and I could go, one that strikes me the 20th century, Warren G. Harding was a real rat. He did all sorts of terrible things, immoral, corrupt, you know, dangerous things. And he's the one students of history judge him as perhaps the greatest failure that we've had, at least in the 20th century. So there's a comparison, I think, we're thinking about. Your line of thought here, I think, is good in the sense that it is remarkable, not only in terms of policy or in terms of power grabbing, you know, corruption, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I mean, the typical maniacal, demagogic, you know, characteristics. He also has this psychological makeup, which is disturbing and also embarrassing. I mean, you know, the thing that he was the Prime Minister of Australia. Mm-hmm. You know, he's become a joke in the heads of state, and it's shocking, really. And and the thing is, he puts it out there. It's hard to argue away. Although, I mean, you see the power of political party identification. People that you know, I know, you know, and I. I do know some Republicans, and some of them will defect, but some of them say, well, he's our candidate. He's the head of our party, and we're going to stay with him. So that's very deep. That's one of the problems we have. People who are on the left or liberals, progressives, somehow, I mean, just first of all, just understanding that barrier and where it's coming from. It's almost in some ways something it's taken for granted. I mean, you know, they're for the Cubs or whatever. They're for the Sox. I'm not saying the Cubs. I'm just doing an analogy of, you know, if your baseball team or whatever your team is, you know how people are about their sports teams. Absolutely. It's that same sort of, often that same sort of intensity of feeling.
It is tribal.
Yeah.
Let's take a brief station break, Michael Lewis Beck, and we'll be back and continuing the conversation after this short break. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And on this 4th of July holiday, we are talking with Michael Lewis Beck, a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Iowa, whose interests include comparative elections, election forecasting, political economy, and quantitative methodology. He has co-authored over 275 articles and books, including Economics and Elections, The American Voter Revisited, French Presidential Elections, and Forecasting Elections. So, given the patriotic theme of our conversation today, even though, as you say, I'm not questioning Trump's patriotism so much as his personality and his personal standards, morals, ethics, etc., they don't seem to be even visible in many cases. He may well be in trouble with the Emoluments Clause, as you mentioned, and he's also...
Well, here's one problem that this creates. I mean, you know, as we were talking earlier, it might be a bit dicey to play boy psychologist and diagnose his mental profile. But one thing we can say is that the behavior we see, the verbal and the physical behavior, he creates a situation of tremendous uncertainty in the political arena. And that is clear. In terms of a president, you know, being a policymaker, his decisions are so whimsical, so sudden, so often random. They seem to come out of nowhere. It's just like in the stock market when suddenly, for no reason anybody can think of, a blue chip stock goes crashing, or some nowhere bankrupt plant suddenly takes off. I mean, this randomness creates a huge uncertainty. And in fact, I mean, the biggest fear I have is I think that the country, well, there's one good thing and one really bad thing. Now, the good thing potentially is that people will just start to ignore him and work around him. You're already starting to see this. I mean, the Republican Party in the Congress is starting to do without him, and he's starting to do without them. And that, in some ways, is freeing. I mean, as much as I might criticize the mainstream Republican Party, I mean, I am happy to do that, but I mean, I think that there are saner heads there than are in the White House. So the really bad thing is, for me, is with this sort of whimsical character, this randomness, this inability or this suddenness, and also making decisions which, just take the uncertainty. He's near the nuclear button, and this is one thing that can keep me up at night, is he has access to world devastation. They're close to his fingertips, and this is something that could, you know. So in this sense, the random behavior could be a disaster.
Well, obviously, that was a theme that Hillary Clinton ran on. And it didn't work, did it?
No. We could talk about. I mean, her. I reluctantly did vote for her, but I knew what we were not getting and what we were getting, and it was faux de mieux. I didn't. I was a Sanders supporter. I mean, yeah, a Sanders supporter until he wasn't running anymore.
Right.
I think, in fact, this is something worth talking about, how the media elites and the political elites moved Bernie to the side. He never really got the hearing he deserved. I wrote an op-ed piece. I've published op-ed pieces before, and I wrote an op-ed piece based on some serious data analysis, which suggested that it was a bipartisan piece. It just said... A nonpartisan piece. It said, if Hillary Clinton wants to be president, she can greatly increase her chances by bringing on Bernie as vice president. And I had numbers to back this up. It seemed very clear, the data seemed very clear, that if she had had Bernie on the ticket, she would have beaten Trump. Now, whether or not they would have ever been able to make that deal, but I wrote this op-ed piece in hopes that it would get someone's attention and pressure the mainstream Democratic team to consider this, just out of a practical, you know, politicians want to win. That's what they want to do. So the argument I was making was, if you want to win, this is what you need to do. You need to swallow the pill and ask Bernie to the table. Now the sad thing is, I sent this op-ed piece to several magazines and outlets in big places. We're at places I've had access, but I didn't get anybody to even print it. And I was shocked by that. So talk about freedom of the press. I mean, you know, of course, maybe it wasn't well written. I don't know. I mean, I think it was pretty well written, and it was written in a lay language people could understand. And I just wanted to get that idea out. And now, especially since what we have now is Trump in the White House, but you know what was remarkable to me, and then I'll shut up about it. I mean, I could only get attention to this among a circle of people who knew me. I could not get this idea into the media, and God knows I tried.
Well, this is the same media, by the way, that gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising.
Yeah,
you know, maybe you can make the case now that they're expiating at least the big papers like the New York Times and the Post and the LA Times and even the Wall Street Journal are doing some very solid investigative pieces that might well bring him down. But they sure as hell, all of them, couldn't wait to follow the bright, shiny light and get seduced by the antics of this guy.
You're right. I mean, I'll tell you another thing. I mean, when, you know, I was in the limelight because of the caucuses, and there was a big a powwow here. Pundits and scholars from all over the country and even came here, a big conclave, to study the caucus and present learned papers and discuss strategies, et cetera, et cetera. And it was very clear to me, I was a participant in this, part of my activities as a political scientist, it was very clear to me that many people from the media or related to the media just thought that Hillary Clinton had it in the bag, and that the notion that there could possibly be a rival candidate for the Democratic nomination wasn't even entertained. Despite the fact that Bernie, when he came to Iowa, nobody knew who he was, and by the time he left the state, he had a 79% popularity rating, whereas when Hillary came, once she set foot on the ground here, her ratings started to drop.
Well,
and then Sanders brought her to a draw in the vote here, and that's another thing that people just didn't want to admit. I mean, she won by a hair.
Right.
But this is just an example of how he was constantly sidelined by the press and by political elites.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've talked to Bernie about this, and she never offered him the vice presidency.
I'm sure she didn't. She hated him, as nearly as I can tell.
And there's no, I mean, he may not have taken it. Who knows?
Exactly.
But we know that the person she chose, Kane, did absolutely nothing for her.
Exactly.
And as far as I can tell, the main reason that she didn't choose him was that her people were still so miffed that he ran against her. How dare you interrupt her coronation?
You've got it right. You've got it right. And no, I mean, that was the attitude all along. And, you know, here on the ground in Iowa, I saw Bernie in action in different places. He you know, you might think Iowa, you know, that's so different from Bernie's background, but he was magnetic with people. He was great on a human level with people of all sorts. And Hillary, I mean, it's like you couldn't. I mean, she did stuff anytime she had a choice. She did the wrong thing here. I mean, Iowans are friendly folks, and she just did not get out and mix it up with the people. She's traveled with her entourage, including her Secret Service and the tent she was always in, and she gave very few, Q&As. She did not make a good impression.
Well, what do you make, though, of this extraordinary phenomenon, Marco Lewis Beck, that the Democratic Party has not learned from Hillary's defeat? And they ran this guy Ossoff down in Georgia, who was another Hillary, running on anything but bread and butter issues, you know,
right,
gender issues, let's all be nice to each other.
Exactly.
That was his campaign theme. He didn't even live in the district.
You're right. It's not, I mean, that was reinforced, what you're saying was reinforced to me after I was recently on the radio and The comments was that you know, we're going to do this all over again. I mean, we're going to run a Republican light president, a middle of the road Democrat again, and we're not going to focus on bread and butter issues about jobs and wages and infrastructure and these things, education for, paying our kids college debts and get their teeth fixed, all these things that ordinary people care about. And that's what the Democrats used to be about. There's no vibe there. Part of the problem, I think, actually, since we're having this conversation, I mean, you can look back. Bill Clinton really began to turn the rudder away. I mean, the Democratic rudder started to turn right with Clinton, with the first Clinton. And when he cut back welfare and, when he increased the incarceration rate, he got in bed with the banks. He really was the one who changed the tune. One of the things also we know, I mean, just in terms of the political science data, since the New Deal, I mean, the union people have been solidly Democrat. Now, this has eroded every election since 1970, something like that, mid-70s. It's been going down the last few elections, especially till now. Basically, union people are marginally, if at all, more likely to vote for Democrats, and that's just because they don't speak up for unions anymore.
So how can you bring back the FDR coalition?
That is a $64 question. One thing that's going to happen now is that in midterms in the United States, with one or two exceptions, at a midterm, the party in the White House always loses seats. On average, they lose about 30 seats. So that means that there will be Republican losses. And they'll probably be, I would guess, they're going to be bigger than that. The good news about that is that that's a historic process. It's based on cost of ruling. Any party, Republican or Democrat, in the White House, they lose votes. This happens worldwide in democracies. It's not just the U.S., parties in power lose votes over time. So I think that will happen. So then what happens, we need candidates that will step up to the plate and take advantage of the historic situation, which is really a golden opportunity. Now, if you look on the horizon, who are the candidates going to be? This was dismaying to me when I asked my friends, who's it going to be? Who's our bright, shining star? Very few names come up. The one that's come up the most, which I actually think is a good idea, I think Al Franken is a potential candidate. So that's something. In terms of, I'm very worried about the Koch brothers and what they're doing, and they've succeeded. I mean, Iowa is squeaky clean in terms of its politics. It's rated about, near the top in terms of no corruption and fair. It's one of the few states where there's no political gerrymandering. The districts are drawn, the boundaries are drawn by courts, which are nonpartisan. But, in fact, I mean, and this is due to the caucuses, more and more outside money is coming to the state and trying to buy candidates, and they've succeeded in some cases. I mean, Joni Ernst is the senator, recently elected senator in Iowa. She was running to replace Senator Harkin, who had retired, and she won. She had a lot of Koch brothers' support. And this is fair. This is new in Iowa politics. And as you know, I mean, the Koch brothers have a team. They go around and they give state in this. They're targeting state legislatures. That's their home base. They go to state legislators. State legislatures are poor by and large. So these folks don't have a big staff. The Koch brothers will provide them with legislative documents, so agendas, bills already written, if they want it, and they offer this service for a very, nominal or no fee. and they support candidates that they want to support. This is one good thing about, I mean, quote unquote, good thing about Trump. The Koch brothers do not like Trump.
Right, but the Koch brothers put the Congress in, as you mentioned, Joni
Ernst. Yeah, right. I know. I'm just trying to be fair-minded here.
Well, yeah, but let's be fair-minded, but also be realistic. You can make the case that the Koch brothers own the American government. They put up close to $1 billion. They said they didn't like Trump. They were going to concentrate on the House and Senate, and they delivered. And all of the agenda that's been passed so far by this Congress and by this president has been the Koch brothers' agenda. Everything. Getting out of the Paris Global Warming Accords,
yep.
Offshore drilling.
It's quite tar distressing.
Sands, bringing back coal, you name all of it, tax cuts for the rich. That's all the Koch brothers. Well, just as a closing thought on our 4th of July patriotic holiday here, give us a last sense of how the resistance can be patriotic.
I think people need to hold fast to the truth and speak out, be courageous, get your sleep, eat your Wheaties, and do get the word out. I mean, part of this is the 4th of July. I mean, the one great thing America, well, there's more than one, but one great thing we gave the world is the idea of the inviolability of free speech. You can say what you want. And, of course, that's been threatened at different times. But this country still is a place, I mean, I spend a lot of time in Europe. They're putting people in jail for saying things that here you can say. Because we think if you say it, that's one thing. If you do it, it's a different thing. So, you know, free speech gets, you know, if someone says something racist or hateful that you don't like, at least you know who it is. You know who your enemy is. If you make that go underground, I mean, the American idea is you get the information out there, you let people talk, and you hear where they stand, and then you make the decisions. And so I think it's important. This is also feeds into the notion of fake truth and fake news. I mean, right. What's really under threat in the long run is, you know, the standards of truth. I mean, I'm a social scientist. I look at science. I do numbers. The notion that you can have a political party in this country, a major party that denies the scientific evidence on global warming, among other things, is just very scary. Because once you throw science out, then you throw all the standards of truth out.
Well, Michael Lewis Beck, thank you for joining us on this 4th of July holiday.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lewis Beck, who is a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Iowa, whose interests include comparative elections, election forecasting, political economy, and quantitative methodology. He has co-authored over 275 articles and books, including Economics and Elections, The American Voter Revisited, French Presidential Elections, and Forecasting Elections. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and producer Clemence Penard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Time.